So last time, we are talking about the causality of local quantum field theories. So today we are going to talk about the first few minutes, causality and the Feynman propagator. For fermions. So the idea is that for local quantum field theories, two space-like separated observable, their commutator should vanish. So if they are separated in a space-like fashion. In scalar field theories, this is implemented at the level of the field by something like this. However, for spinners, you can show that this thing, the commutator of, say, two free Dirac spinners, let's use A and B, that the commutator does not vanish for space-like separated points. However, the observables in for fermions are always created out of bilinears of psi and psi bar. So fermionic observables usually have this form. Where this gamma is usually some combination of gamma matrix. So we don't need psi and psi bar, the commutator of psi and psi bar, to vanish. What we need rather, something like this to hold true. Everybody is here with their food. Yeah?
I just have like a very basic question, but how do we know that the important operators are commutators or anti-commutators? How do you know that we cannot have a combination of them or something else different altogether?
It's a very good question. So we basically interpret a commutator in a rough sense as being when two operators commute, we say that, you know, we can simultaneously observe them. So we would expect that, you know, two observables, if they're space-like separated, the observation of these two observables should not influence each other in a relativistic local quantum field theory. So that's why this is a condition that we want for, in general, from our local quantum field theories. Okay, so it comes from the old quantum mechanical, result that when two operators commute, we can simultaneously observe them. Those do not have any intuitive, you know, physical interpretation. You know, they are connected to the spin statistics theorem and the, but the things that we observe, the fermionic, the observables related, associated with fermionic variables are always bilinears in psi bar and psi. So in general, if you compute this, you find this is a matrix acting on some function where this function, some kind of a propagator, well, it's actually the delta function, but this is a distribution. In quantum field theories, commutator or anti-commutators of field operators turn out to be distributions. And one way of thinking about this is that these objects don't vanish within the light cone, but they should vanish outside the light cone. You know, this is the requirement of causality, but if you examine the analyticity properties of functions which don't vanish in part of your space-time and then suddenly vanish at, you know, another part of space-time, then you can argue that they are not analytic functions. So, you know, they must actually be distributions. So if you, now you can show that this, when the point x and y are space-like separated, then this thing vanishes. And to show this, what you want to do is that you want to take, say, the second guy. So in the second expression, x and y would be swapped. And then you can choose a reference frame in which x naught is equal to y naught. So if x and y are space-like separated, you can always do that. And once you do that, the time component from this exponential drops out. And then what you have is that the space component, but then you can take the p to minus of p, the spatial, and since this is, the measure is invariant under taking p to minus p, you see that when x and y are space-like separated, these two terms cancel out.
How did you get the form of
the? We calculated it. You just you use the you know the expressions for these guys. You expand those out, and then you use the spin sums, stuff like that, and that's how you derive this. So recall that Dyson's, yeah?
Can you give an example of a fermionic observable which is constructed in
that? All right, sure. So for example, we can say electric charge. So the electric charge for a fermionic field would be, it's actually not local, but you can think of charge density as a version of this. So, you know, charge density in some small point, some small region in space, say sigma. And that would be given by psi bar gamma zero of psi, right? So that's an example of something that is bilinear. And there are other things such as if you compute the energy momentum stress tensor and Hamiltonian, everything you, it kind of turn, they turn out to be bilinear.
How do you see that the communication of the two observables, so I mean from that the observable is the first one and the second one?
So can you repeat your question?
How can we see that the commutator of the two observables, so a maple timeline? Like, even though we know that the anti-commutator of the two is...
Oh, right, okay, sure. So essentially what you do is, so if you have something like this, say A, B, and C, D, and then you have C, D minus C, D, A, B, and then you can rewrite this. I may make some mistakes right now, but you know, the idea is that you add a term where, say, you insert like an anti-commutator of C and B, for example, A of C and B and D, and then you subtract this term, A C B of D minus C D A B, and then this term gives you an anti-commutator, and then you have these terms. So there is, if you keep on doing this, eventually you will, you know, get an expression where, you know, you can actually express the commutator of two bilinear combination in terms of anti-commutators. You could have also done that by in terms of commutators. So there's some details involved that you know you can figure out, but that's the idea, is that you can actually do this. So now recall that Dyson's formula involves time ordering. So, you know, what that result tells us is that, you know, time ordering is Lorentz invariant if two space-like separated. Right. So, you know, time ordering, the time ordering operator is Lorentz invariant if the two points you're considering are time-like separated, right? So essentially what you're saying is that, you know, I'm considering two points, this point X and this point Y, but Y is in the light cone of X, therefore they're time-like separated. And so, you know, for those cases, time ordering in, you know, Lorentz transformation will not change the time ordering of X and Y, right? But if two points are, you know, space-like separated, then time ordering is ambiguous. Unless, you know, the time ordering of, you know, unless the time ordering of two fermionic operators anti-commute for space-like separated points, then the whole thing is Lorentz invariant, right? That's basically what that result is saying, is that psi A and psi B bar, they are zero when they are, you know, when they're space-like separated, okay? So this motivates the definition of the Feynman propagator. So the Feynman propagator for spinners, which we use, for which we use S. And this is a matrix, so we can use spinner labels AB, is given by the time ordering of psi and psi bar where the time ordering is defined to be but we insert a minus sign if and the minus sign is motivated by the fact that suppose that our x and y are time-like separated, then whether x naught is greater than y naught or y naught is greater than x naught will depend on our reference frame. Yeah? No, the A's and B's are not swapped, actually, because this is a slightly different calculation from that, but no, the definition of the Feynman propagators actually has, yeah.
Yeah. Should that be psi bar or psi dagger? What's the difference? Because in your notes you've got dagger.
Even over here?
When you say, for example, psi A, anything instead of psi A, psi B bar, it is zero.
Right.
Well, in your notes, it seems.
Oh, so why do you think it should be a dagger there?
It's just because in your notes it says so.
Oh, did I say dagger there?
Yeah.
Ah. Oh, I see, right. I think it also holds for psi bar. Let me check that. But I think it also holds for psi bar, yes.
And one more question. When A is in front,
right,
and phi is in front, isn't it the outer product?
Yes.
But the below one is the inner product.
No, it's not an inner product. It's they're both, because you're taking the, there's no, there. If it was inner product, then there would be a sum. You would have the same A's over here, and there would be an implied sum. So there, this is not an inner product, okay? Yes, I mean, I'm just taking components of psi and psi bar, okay? So, textbooks will basically do this. They will say, okay, this thing is time ordering of psi and psi bar. And they will not, give you the labels. But what they mean is exactly this thing.
Okay. So A here runs from 1 to 4.
Right. So this is a 4x4 matrix. Yes?
Did the brackets around in the first line mean anything around everything?
Yeah, but I think I was going to give some AB, but yeah. Yeah, no. That's a very good question. So, explicitly, right, why we should, okay, so the idea is that suppose that your two points of space-time are space-like separated. So this is your x and this is your y, okay? So according to somebody's reference frame, y naught is greater than x naught. So time ordering, you know, let's do this. We have, say, call this y, and this is x. So time ordering of these, so these operators are already time ordered then, right? So now, in somebody else's reference frame, you know, this point x is in the, sorry, this point y is in the future of x. Somebody else's reference frame, right? So in that, because they're space-like separated, in that person's reference frame, you know, these operators are no longer time ordered. However, these operators are, this ordering is time ordered. But we saw that, you know, for space-like separated points, you know, this guy is actually related to this guy by a minus sign, right? That the anti-commutator, it's the anti-commutator which vanishes. So for for this product to be actually, for the time ordering to be invariant for different reference frames for points which are space-like separated, you have to insert a minus sign over here.
Is not really using the commutator relationship, like it is just matter of ordering, right? Then, like, can I still get rid of them?
No, I mean, then, you know, this would be a definition which will not, this will not be a Lorentz invariant definition. That's the point, is that if you want something to be Lorentz invariant, it has to be Lorentz invariant not just inside the light cone, but also outside the light cone. And outside the light cone, you know, you have to respect the fact that, you know, the ordering of points is ambiguous outside the light cone. Okay.
Why do these observables even have to be Lorentz invariant? Because when you talk about, say, charge density,
right,
you totally see, like, oh, if you boost, then you have Lorentz contraction, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Charge density is not a scalar. It's a zeroth component of a four vector. So that's why it's not a Lorentz invariant. Yeah. Sorry? You mean this?
Yeah.
Should we swap them? No. You can actually compute this. This is not
but,
the.
But then the commutator. We just want to use a commutator relation.
Yeah, I know. That's but you know, this is actually a slightly different computation from there, but the Feynman propagator actually has these indices. Let me give you the expression for this, okay? Yeah?
The way you define the propagator with a scalar field is like you have a particle being created at a certain point and then it propagates to another point.
Right.
And so with that definition in mind, shouldn't you have psi dagger in place of psi bar?
Psi bar also has in it a, it also has in it the Cartesian annihilation operator. But the thing is that, we are going to apply this to some scattering calculation of some S matrix. And
there, you know, everything that's entering in those computation will be something Lorentz invariant or Lorentz covariant. So the stuff that you want to consider there is psi bar.
This is A and B. You have, you're saying you have a 4x4 matrix, right?
Right.
So, but how will the second term give you a matrix, psi bar psi?
Yeah, that's because you are thinking of this as a matrix multiplication. I'm not. The definition makes clear that it is not a matrix multiplication. Okay.
You can think of the first one as some sort of outer product, but the second one is not, right? It's not a, okay? So what is the expression for this thing? So explicitly, the fermionic, time-ordered, the fermionic Feynman propagator, which people usually write it without bothering to write down the explicit spinorial indices. Is given by this. And so in this expression, the zeroth component of the momentum four vector is not related to the three component. So the P vector is not on mass shell. And the plus I epsilon prescription tells you, how the contour should be taken if you're doing the P zero integral. And the contour prescription is that if x naught is what less than y naught, then you should do the p zero integral in this fashion. So this is a p zero plane, and the denominator has zeros in minus of EP and plus of EP. And along the real line, you take the contour to go below this pole and above this pole. And for this thing, for you to be able to use the Cauchy residue theorem, you basically have to close your contour in the upper half plane. So if, on the other hand, if your x naught is greater than y naught, then on the real axis, you do the same thing as before. But then you close the contour on the lower half plane. And what this plus I epsilon tells you is that if you now work out what the poles are of this integrand, then it pushes this, it pushes the this pole a little bit above the real axis and pushes this a little bit below the real axis. Right. So that, you know, in the doing the contour integral, the contour which lies along the real axis can just go along the real axis. You don't have to go, you don't have to do the mouse hole things. Okay. So this is the definition of the Feynman propagator, but we really want to see how all of these machinery kind of comes together in giving us amplitudes and cross sections in some interacting theory. So I'll move on to our next topic, which is the discussion of an interacting theory, which involves fermion. And it's a theory that is quite old. And it's called the Yukawa theory. Now, this will be a theory in which was originally proposed by Yukawa in the 1930s as a theory describing strong interactions of between nucleons. So he proposed that nucleons, such as protons and neutrons, interact by exchanging a massive spin zero pseudoscalar particle called meson. However, in the example that we're going to consider today, we'll take the spin zero particle to be a scalar rather than a pseudoscalar, just for simplicity. And so Yukawa was motivated to introduce a massive particles to explain the very short range of nuclear forces. Okay. Yeah?
So the neutron is a scalar, right? So it's not technically a scalar particle, which is the projection of the... So I mean, we choose really to use a scalar particle.
It's a pseudoscalar.
Oh, okay, fine, but I mean a scalar particle, I mean, as a pseudoscalar as just one.
Right, so meson, yeah, exactly. So you're trying to say is that we know that the meson actually has internal structure, right? And therefore, it's not a fundamental scalar. But you know, that's the thing about quantum field theory is that quantum field theory doesn't have to describe just the fundamental particles. It can describe composite systems too. And you just have to be—you have to know that you know at what energy scale your theory breaks down. So if you So yeah, you're right, but you know, at the same time, you know, we can, you know, we can treat. Yeah, we can build up a quantum field theory for mesons. You can.
Yukawa really did this. He actually thought it was not a composite particle, right?
Well, you know, it is. Even if it's a composite particle, it is still a scalar.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's just that, you know, some people think that the Higgs boson is actually a composite particle. You know, there are theories. So that doesn't make it less of a scalar particle, right? And, you know, that's also, you know, that's a whole point of view take when you're trying to do condensed matter physics, because, you know, in condensed matter physics, when you're describing the system in terms of quantum field theory, you know that at some point, you know, this comes from some lattice models or something like this, right? So at that level, it's no longer a quantum field theory, but there's an effective description
in which, you know, those particles are excitations of a quantum field, right? So the Yukawa, a generalization of the Yukawa interaction, so a generalization of the Yukawa interaction, plays the role of renormalizable coupling between the chiral fermions and Higgs field in the standard model, which respects the gauge symmetries. Of the theory. So in your standard model course, you'll see that the left-handed fermions in the standard models, they enter in a way that is different from the way that right-handed fermions enter in the standard model. And it's a generalization of the Yukawa interaction, which actually relates the left-handed fermions and the right-handed fermions via the Higgs boson, and which also respects the symmetries of the theory. And it's this interaction term which, after what is known as spontaneous symmetry breaking, when the Higgs boson gets a vacuum expectation value, gives mass to the fermions. All I'm saying is the generalization of the Yukawa interaction plays a very important role in model building and in the standard model. So just to motivate it. Sorry?
Is chiral fermion the viral spinner?
Yeah, so basically, although the fermions we observe in nature are, they're massive, when you write down the standard model, you find that if you write a mass term there, that will violate the symmetries of the theory. So you're not allowed to write down a direct mass term coupling the left-handed vowel and the right-handed vowel spinners. And that's done through the Yukawa interaction. The Yukawa interaction generates mass in a clever way. So our theory will be a scalar version of the Yukawa theory. So it's a theory of nucleons. So we are doing nuclear physics. So there'll be a fermionic part, there'll be a scalar part, and there'll be an interaction part, which I'm writing Yukawa, L Yukawa. And the fermionic part, let's just take one nucleon, say the neutron. Then the fermionic part is just the free Dirac Lagrangian, where at the tree level, the mass is the mass of a neutron. And the L phi is the Lagrangian for a real scalar field. This will be our meson. which has mass capital M, and in nuclear physics, this is much, it's greater than capital M. I think, what is this? Is like a 1 GV or something, and this is several hundred MeV. And the interaction term I'll choose that to be minus of phi psi bar of psi. You can absorb the minus sign in a redefinition of phi. So this is just a convention. So we know that this guy has mass dimension 3/2. The scalar field has mass dimension 1. And therefore, you know, this combination of fields have mass dimension of 4. And therefore, the mass dimension of our coupling constant is 0. We also take our coupling constant to be positive. So this theory has a U1 symmetry. So U1 phase symmetry, where you take psi to E alpha of psi and psi bar to minus E alpha of psi. And we interpret that being the baryon number symmetry, the nucleon number symmetry. So the conserved charge here is the conservation of the number of neutrons minus antineutrons, or nucleons minus antineutrons. So it turns out that when you do the standard model course, yes, Alex?
Is it obvious that it is a pseudoscalar?
No, okay, here I'm choosing this to be a scalar.
Oh.
So the thing is that in nature, it turns out that the pions are pseudoscalars, but that theory does respect parity. So the original Yukawa coupling was actually had this form. Because this was a pseudoscalar, this had to be a pseudoscalar interaction. Yeah?
Does the kinetic part change if you have a pseudoscalar?
No.
Okay.
So the standard model, it turns out, also has some of these U1 symmetries. Global U1 symmetries, and they're called baryon number conservation and lepton number conservation. And it turns out that those U1 symmetries in the standard model are accidental, meaning that you wanted to write down a theory which was invariant under what is called gauge symmetry. You'll see that in the next few lectures and in the next course. But it turned out, after you wrote down that Lagrangian, that it also had some global U1 symmetries. And those global U1 symmetries turn out to be the conservation of baryon number and the conservation of lepton number. And in fact, when people try to generalize the standard model to some grand unified theory, some of these symmetries are broken. So those are all asides. Okay, I'm running out of time. So just as, you know, Dan did an LSZ, formula for the bosons, there are LSZ formulae for the fermions as well. But it implies that you can, so I'm not going to prove the LSZ theorem all over again, but it implies that we can treat their asymptotic states as if they were free states. And that the creation operators and the annihilation operators in the interaction picture satisfy the same algebra as they did in the free theory. and we want to figure out what the matrix elements are from the Dyson series. So we want to compute this order by order. But this is the interaction Hamiltonian density in the interaction picture. So before we can go and do calculation for the Yukawa theory, we need to know what is Wick's theorem for fermions. And the Wick's theorem for fermion is given by this. If you have two fermionic operators, Dirac operators, then the normal ordering, and remember that when we are normal ordering the creation and annihilation operator, and we are we have to anticommute those operators, so we have a minus sign that'll come when the creation and annihilation operators are anticommuted. And and the Feynman propagator, we call this a contraction, where our notation is that the contraction of two operators is defined to be this if and all other contractions are zero. So so in general, yeah. Thank you. So in general, if you have a time ordering of, say, many you know, Fermi Dirac operator, then we will have one term, you know, which will be the normal ordering of these guys, and plus terms with all possible constructions. So the point I want to make now is that in all possible contraction, there will be terms like this. We have psi 1, say psi 2. Okay, let's put the psi 3 here, the dab bar here, and psi 3 bar. And so you write the possible contraction inside the normal ordering. But you know that this object is a function. This is no longer an operator. So, but to bring out that function, you have to anticommute psi 3 with psi 2. So you will have to rewrite this term as minus of psi 1 psi 3 bar contraction, and then psi 2. And then you bring out psi 1 psi 3 bar, and then the normal ordering starts with psi 2 and goes like this. So to prove these results, it'll just take us like way too much time, and you know, it's too boring. So we are not going to go into that. But you do need to have some results about the time ordering of fermionic operators. But for today's, you know, yeah. So. So the rest of today's class, we want to do a calculation in great detail. And we are going to derive the Feynman rules from that calculation. And the calculation that I want to do is the scattering of two nucleons in this theory. So we'll be treating how two nucleons scatter off each other. And recall that our field operators have a part which contains the creation operator, the annihilation operator for the particle, and the creation operator for the antiparticle. And psi bar of x has a creation operator for the particle and an annihilation operator for the particle. So this guy contains B. This guy contains C dagger. This contains B dagger, and this contains C. Yeah?
So you have a nuclear field,
right? Right. Nucleons and antinucleons. So, for example, if you have like a neutron, in nature, antineutrons exist. If you have a proton, then antiprotons exist. However, we are so that's yeah. So the
whatever.
But if you talk about protons, I think we should talk about neutrons here because protons also have electromagnetic interaction, and we are going to not include electromagnetic interaction.
So does that think of it concretely as neutron scattering?
Yeah.
One?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the expression, although you know these are now interacting fields in the interacting picture, we can, you know, the LSZ, framework tells us that we can actually use the same, expansion as we did in the free theory. And similarly, for the scalar field, you know, we will have some annihilation operator part and a creation operator part. And the scalar field annihilation operator, we write that as A. And the creation operators, we write that as A dagger. Then the incoming state that we are interested in is a two-particle nucleon state. So this has some momentum P, some polarization S. Acting on the vacuum. And here, what we have done is that we have canceled all the vacuum diagrams. So, and the out or the final state is some particle which has momentum p prime, spin p prime, and some spin polarization r prime, and let's call this k. And let's call this k prime. And let's call this P prime. Then the conjugate of the final state will have annihilation operators acting on the bra. And the mental picture that we have is that, you know, two particles coming in, doing something, and two particles going out. And the particles that are coming in have momentum labels K and P, spin polarization labels S and R. The particles which are going out have spin momentum polarization P prime, K prime, and R prime and S prime. Our interaction Hamiltonian has this form. Now, because you see psi has psi plus and psi minus, when we look at the order lambda term of the S matrix, so then because neither the final state nor the initial state has a meson in it, the creation and the annihilation operator, contained in this, is going to destroy either the initial state or the final state. Right. So psi plus acting on the initial state, and psi minus acting on the final state is going to give us zero. So that means that we are not going to have any contribution to our scattering matrix from the order of lambda term. So the first non-trivial contribution would be order of lambda squared term. Yes. Phi plus has annihilation operator A. Phi minus has creation operator A dagger. Yeah.
This is going to give zero just because you're going to have like a single phi left in the end?
Yeah, because that's, exactly, because the initial state or the final state doesn't have any psi creation or annihilation operator. So the creation and annihilation operator in phi is either going to destroy those guys. So our first non-trivial contribution will come from the lambda squared term. So let's write down the transfer matrix, or the T matrix. So this will have, so our final state, the time ordering operator will have two integrals, and then I will write a subscript to denote that their argument is at x1. And this guy will have an argument at x2. And this is the initial state.
And now you use the Wick's theorem to contract these two phis. And the term that is going to contribute is the one where the phis are contracted. All the other terms where the psis are contracted, you can show that for these initial and for this final state, those terms will give you zero. So these guys also have B operators and C operators in them. The B operators create and annihilate nucleon. The C operators create and annihilate antinucleons. Because our initial and final states do not have any antinucleons in them, if we expand this out, the parts which contain the C operators will not contribute because they will, again, destroy those states because those states do not have any C particles in them. So the only parts that we are interested in here are the B parts and the B dagger parts. So that gives us this expression where we have I of t is minus, which will come from ordering of fermionic operators. And we have the space-time integrals again. And then what we do is that we take these two psis and do an expansion of these two psis. So we have two, three momentum integrals coming from those expansion. And then our final state. And we have two spin sums coming from the expansion of psi 1 and psi 2. Let's call them t and t prime. And from this, we have psi minus, which contains b, b dagger, actually. And this is at the spacetime point x1, contracted with the spinner u of t of k1, which comes from the expansion of or one of these guys, and then I think this one, yeah. And then we have similarly psi minus of 2 contracted with t prime k2. And we have an exponential coming from those expansion as well. And then multiplying this is a string of fermionic creation and annihilation operators. So we get bt and bt prime of k1 and k2. And then we write our initial state explicitly as bs dagger of k of br dagger of p, acting on the vacuum. And then we also have the contraction. So now we have these four creation and annihilation operators, and you can use the commutation relationship, and then you can show that this thing, just this thing, is given by, oh, by the way, this minus sign comes from the fact that this annihilation operator B was between this operator and this operator, And we did an anti-commutation to bring it over here. And that's where this minus sign comes in. Okay? So now we can take this thing and just use your anti-commutation relationships, and then you get this expression. The point is, this is a long and boring calculation, but at the end of it, when we formulate the Feynman rules, you can show that this calculation can be done, the result can be written down in about 5 minutes at most, and therefore, you know, it's worth learning the Feynman rules. So now, using the fact that we have these delta functions, I'm missing a delta function over here. There should be a delta of, I think, k2 minus p here. So now we can use these delta functions to do those, you know, the k1 and k2 integral. And you have as a result, this expression. So I of t, once you do the delta function integrals, and now we can expand the final state in terms of the annihilation operator acting on the bra of the vacuum. Psi bar of minus, there's a minus sign here, dot u of s at k, u bar 2 dot u r of p, and minus I k dot x1 minus I p dot x2, and then plus psi minus 1 of u r of p, and then psi 2 minus dot u s of k. Wherever I say dot, what I mean is that you're taking, this is the spinner inner product, so this is a conjugate spinner, there's a spinner, and the dot means that, you know, we are summing over the spinner indices. And we have e to the power minus I p dot x1 minus I k dot x2. And bracket ends, and the vacuum phi1 and phi2. So now we can do the same thing as we did before and expand the psi bar minuses and do an analogous calculation. And from the doing the expanding the psi bars, we will get more factors of the exponentials. We'll get two more factors of the exponentials that we'll have to add to these guys. But we also use the fact that phi 1 and phi 2, which is a scalar propagator, has some expression like this, which you saw in Dan's part of the course. And basically, so then you put all of this together and do the d4x1 and d4x2 integral. And when you do the d4x1 and d4x2 integral, you have, okay, so I'm skipping over some details. Some of the details are given in my notes. I encourage you to look at that. You have this integral over the momentum space coming from the propagator of the scalars. The scalar propagator and, made a mistake. Okay. Right. So when you do the integral over the d4x1 and d4x2, you get two delta functions. And there, before you did that x1 and x2 integral, you actually expanded the psi bar 1 and psi 2 bar, and they came with their own momentum integrals, but then you use the anti-commutation relationships along with this guy to generate some delta functions, and you use those delta functions to do the momentum integrals. Once you've done that, you'll have to do the x1 and x2 integrals, and that will give you two more new delta functions, just all delta functions. So when the dust settles, you get this expression. So that's one term. The other term has a minus sign in it. So now you can use these delta functions to do the Q integral. That'll get rid of one of the delta function, and what you have left over is an overall momentum conservation delta function. So overall, you have 2 pi 4, some four-dimensional delta function, which says that the total momentum is conserved. And then you have minus I lambda squared And then you have this, okay, I'm just gonna, so these guys essentially, okay, let me just write this out. U bar of R of P prime, there's an R prime here, U of S of, because these labels always come together. So this is a scalar quantity and multiplied by another scalar quantity made out of spinners. Divided by a factor coming from the Feynman propagator. Minus a similar term, but with important differences. Again, a scalar. Okay. So the let me use a curly bracket here. Now the stuff in the curly bracket is what Dan called the matrix element IM, right? Because he did not include this delta function in his definition. So we can now interpret these IM, the two terms in the IM, in the following way. Sorry for rushing through this, but we need to formulate the Feynman rules so that we can apply them in today's tutorial. Okay, so just let me remind you that this is what we are calling IM. So the first term, we can interpret that as, so this factor, as an incoming nucleon with momentum k and spin label s, and outgoing nucleon with spin label, momentum p prime and spin label r prime. And we'll put an arrow like this, and I'll come back to why the arrow. And we can interpret this factor as another nucleon coming in with momentum label P, spin label R, and going out with momentum label K prime it should be, yeah, K, and K prime and spin label S prime. And this 1 over this factor, we can think of it as them exchanging a virtual particle whose momentum is p minus k prime. And the second term we can interpret as something coming in with the same momentum and spin labels, but now the particle going out from here with p prime and r prime, the particle going out here has momentum k prime and spin label s prime. And over here we have right. So P prime n r prime. And let me assess an arrow here. And this guy has momentum p minus p prime. So by making this interpretation, we can now extract the following Feynman rules. Yes. Yes. Right, yeah, okay. So we can extract the following Feynman rules. So number one is that, so for each incoming fermion with momentum P and spin label S, you know, we write a spinner factor of U of S and momentum P. So an incoming fermion we denote by an arrow like that, and it's coming in with some momentum P spin S. So we associate this factor where it's U S of P. So if the fermion was outgoing, then and has momentum P and S, we write U bar of S of P. And the number three is that we label fermion arrow fermion lines by an arrow. So we label by an arrow. And the arrow follows the direction of time. So the arrow but when we write down these factors associated with an incoming and outgoing fermion, we write down the above factors from left to right while following the fermion line in the opposite direction to the arrow. So this probably just kind of sounds convoluted, but what I mean is this. When you see a fermion line, you put arrows on it such that the arrow follows the same direction as the flow of time. Here, time is going this way. So to apply the first two Feynman rules, you take one of these fermion arrows and you go like this, the opposite direction. So you see that here there's an outgoing fermion. So because there's an outgoing fermion, according to the Feynman rules, which are hidden now, you write a U bar. So because in English we write from left to right, you first write this U bar and give the labels. And then when you come here, you find an incoming fermion. So for that, you write an U. So from left to right, while you follow the arrow in the opposite direction. This way, you get a nice scalar object. If you didn't follow that ordering, then you would not get a scalar object, right? So now we could have done this calculation, say, for some anti-fermion scattering, so some anti-neutron scattering. Then we would have arrived at the Feynman rule that incoming anti-fermion, you should assign as V bar. So this is coming in some momentum P, spin label R. But now you put the arrow which goes against the flow of time, the direction the time is going. And you associate UR of P. And for the outgoing, antifermion, you associate V of R of P. So can you see here? This is bad, okay. Let me just draw it here. So you have an outgoing antifermion, and the arrow labels is in the direction opposite to the way the time flows. And for this, you get V of R of P. And then you have an analogous rule for the antifermion. As I said, the arrow that labels the antifermion lines should go against the direction in which time is flowing. And then when you write down these rules, again, you follow the arrow against. Write it down by going against the direction of the arrow. So you write down from left to right while going against the direction of the flow of charge, okay? So if you follow these rules, you get, these are basically the rule that gives you the grammar by which you write down, the amplitude associated with Feynman diagrams. Sorry.
And the V bar in left both sides of the.
Yeah, because otherwise, you would not get a Lorentz invariant object, right? So if you follow these rules, then you automatically get something that is Lorentz invariant. And then the next rule is that, so associate a factor of minus I lambda or plus I lambda if that's the, depending on what interaction term you wrote down, with any of these vertices. So a fermion coming in and an antifermion coming in, or say a fermion going out and an antifermion going out,
or say a fermion coming in, a fermion going out, or an antifermion coming in, an antifermion going out. At no point in a theory where charge is conserved can the direction of an arrow flip. Okay, that would, so in essence, the arrow gives you the direction of the flow of charge. So the other thing that we had was that so if you wrote down, you know, those diagrams using our Feynman rules and also the Feynman rule for the propagator, for the scalar propagator, which you saw in Dan's part of the course, this would still not account for the minus sign over here. And to figure out this minus sign for fermionic particle is a subtle business, and today's tutorial will be devoted to this minus sign. Okay? But in this case, right. Okay, so my number 7 of my Feynman rule is just the generalization of this guy for antifermion, which I'm not going to write down. It's in the notes. You basically change the direction of the arrow. So then you can, so number 7 is for antifermion. And then you could have considered another experiment where a fermion scattered with a meson, and if you work that out, you get that a fermion internal line, you associate this object. This is the fermion propagator, or the Dirac fermion propagator in momentum space. Give me 1 minute, Lord Vader. So number 9 is impose momentum conservation at each vertex and in this case, you can see that you can get the first diagram from the second diagram and vice versa if you relabel the external states, the outgoing fermionic states, by you're doing one relabeling. So in some sense, this could be, this is the, you know, if you think of it in terms of what happened in terms of the creation and annihilation operators, you can show that the two different diagrams came from the same set of operators, but had to be rearranged in such a way that involved an odd number of permutations. And that minus sign actually is the origin of that. And as I said, you know, this is a subtle issue, an important issue that, you know, we'll do some examples in today's tutorial. So I'm not going to, there is no mindless Feynman rules for this. That's the, you know, that is, you actually have to kind of understand quantum field theory a little bit to figure out this minus sign in general, okay? So, you know, so I'll just write minus sign due to, you know, Fermi statistics. And then the other thing is that if you have some loops, you have to integrate over undetermined loop momentum. So integrate over some undetermined loop momentum. So for example, if you compute this, if you have a particle, a meson coming in with some momentum p, then the momentum of the fermion in that loop are undetermined. And you have to integrate over that. And lastly, you associate a minus one with fermion loops. Yeah, you trace over it. You trace over the spins. Yeah. Okay, so these are the complete Feynman rules. Sorry for rushing, but I just had to get there.
The same or
two? So this is the propagator for the fermion.
And for meson.
Okay. So you want me to write down the propagator for the meson?
I just want to, it's one over.
Yeah. So the okay the meson propagator, you're right. So is I over P squared minus big M squared I epsilon. Okay, so that's your, that's all, yeah, sorry, that's also the meson propagator for the internal meson line. Because the meson is not charged, there's no arrow on it, okay? Okay, so let's stop there.